Well, the man who brought us the incredible story of the Global Consciousness Project is back as we talk about supernormal science, yoga, and the evidence for extraordinary psychic abilities. Dean Radin is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Dean Radin, PhD, has been studying advanced capacities of human consciousness for more than 30 years. Presently, the chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences and adjunct faculty member of the Department of Psychology at Sonoma State University, previously worked at Princeton University, worked in Scotland, AT&T Bell Labs, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Dean, always a pleasure. How are you?
Hi, George. It's good to be back on the program.
What's new these days? You haven't been on for a while. So what have you been up to?
Well, I've been involved in quite a few research projects and, of course, my new book. In terms of research, I can give you a quick update on the Global Consciousness Project.
Yeah, I'd love to hear that. And explain to those new people, Dean, what that is.
Well, one way to explain it is that for about 50 years, there have been experiments looking at the relationship between mind and matter in a laboratory. And almost all of those experiments involved one person trying to influence one target. The target that's been used most often has been a random number generator. This is an electronic circuit that is designed to pump out random bits, zeros and ones, in sequence. And by design, each zero and each one is completely independent of every other one. So this provides a very simple target where, through statistics, you can see if the device is being influenced. And the basic notion was that you wanted a system where when you trace down to what is causing a zero or a one to come out, it needs almost no force at all. So it's like a very finely tuned balance.
How close does somebody have to be to the random generator, Dean, in order to influence it?
Well, that was one of the questions that was studied extensively in the laboratory. Most often, the person is just a couple of feet away. But then people asked the same question you did and started to go 20 feet away, half a mile, 10 miles, 100 miles. And it doesn't seem that distance makes any difference at all.
Wow. So they don't physically have to see the generator. If they think of the ones or the zeros, time and space has nothing to do with it.
Right. And distance and space is already kind of challenging. Distance through time is much more challenging, but it turns out that these experiments actually work with a time delay as well. So as a result of these experiments going for such a long time, one of my colleagues at Princeton, Roger Nelson, got the idea that maybe the reason why the random generators are changing is not simply due to intention, but maybe also to attention, and not even attention focused on the random generator. So what he started to do was to take a random generator in the vicinity of a group, like a group meditating or a choral group, or some group that was doing something that involved large group attention to a single object or single focus, and actually even unaware of the fact that there was a random generator there. What he found was that when the group was involved in something that might be called the zone, or they were in the flow, that the amount of randomness that these devices produce went down. In other words, it became more orderly. And so as a metaphor, a way of thinking about what's happening here is that what a random generator does is it's a device designed to produce maximum entropy. That means maximum disorder. And so if any form of order appears, if the thing is forced to become coherent,
then something's going on.
Something's happening.
Yeah.
And so what it's correlated with are periods where minds are all attending to the same thing. And so you can say that in a mental space, there is suddenly order. There is new form of coherence as a result of many minds thinking about the same thing.
Can one also affect a Dean as opposed to many?
Oh, yes. Yeah. This is the previous half a century of effort, seeing whether or not a single person can do this. The answer is yes, to a small degree. But these new experiments are now looking at what's happening when groups also go into order and disorder. So we, Roger and me and a few other colleagues, were at a bar in Germany in 1997, and we were thinking over a couple of beers of, wouldn't it be interesting if we had random number generators in cities around the world running continually, and were being all the data was being uploaded to a web server in Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
And then if an unexpected event occurred, something like an earthquake or a terrorist act that attracted huge amounts of attention around the world, we could then go look at the data that was being continually produced and see whether it in fact had been changed as a result of all this worldwide attention.
And these, again, the data would be one in zeros?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So let me
cite an example and explain it for us so you can have even a better perspective of this. Let's assume the random generators are operating and we get a tragedy. One of the shuttles goes down, right? Several years ago. What would that show on the random generators? Would they have like more ones than zeros, or what would the results show?
It actually, the statistic that we use is not so much that there are more ones or more zeros, but that there's a different form of order that's created. So let me describe that.
Okay.
When you collect, what the generators are asked to do by computers is to produce 200 bits, and each bit is then called a sample, or each of those 200 bits is called a sample. If you start collecting samples of 200 bits where you simply add up the number of ones and zeros, on average, you should end up with a number about 100. It's simply adding up
50-50
zeros and ones,
yeah,
and you end up with something like 100. If you keep adding those up, then you're going to end up with something that looks a lot like a bell-shaped curve. You're going to get mostly 100, but you're going to get sometimes a little over 100, sometimes a little under 100. You keep doing that, you end up with a very nice bell-shaped curve,
okay.
Actually a binomial curve. For those of you who know about statistics. So what we look for then is during a period of very high attention, we see a change in the shape of that bell. The bell actually becomes flattened. There's too many cases, too many samples that have too many ones in them, and some also too many samples with too many zeros in them.
Okay.
So if you imagine a bell-shaped curve, it's as though the bell becomes flattened out. That's what we see. And that represents the same kind of order. It's order where there's too many ones or too many zeros. That's a kind of order. That's the change that we see in the randomness.
And what does that tell you when you see that flatness?
Well, it tells us that the generators are no longer behaving the way they were designed to behave. They're behaving in an orderly manner. So you don't expect these kinds of patterns to appear in randomness. And as I said, since the circuits were originally designed from the get-go not only to produce a truly random sequence, but to also exclude mundane influences. So they're impervious to ionizing radiation, and they're impervious to temperature changes, and they don't change when there's fluctuations in line voltage, and all of the usual ways you'd think of a system being pushed. All of that is excluded by design. So what you can say then is some form of informational change that is changing the nature of randomness itself. We also then, we're pretty sure, we haven't checked this, but we're pretty sure that these effects are not just showing up in the random generators. They're affecting everything. We just are not measuring everything. But in principle, if what we're saying is, if we're interpreting it correctly, then when there's a large-scale mental attention, it changes everything in the physical world. And so if we were to measure human physiology or measure plants or measure virtually anything, that during periods of high attention, high worldwide attention, everything would become a little bit more orderly or coherent.
Now, when that is happening, does it generally reflect before the event or after the event?
Well, that's a good question. When one of the first times that we noticed what appeared to be an effect before the event unfolded was 9/11. So when 9/11 occurred, we did see a deviation in the worldwide generators. But we looked beforehand, and we saw that about 3 hours before 9/11 became known to everyone, that the overall system was beginning to deviate already. So there's some sort of order appearing roughly 3 hours beforehand. So then we went back to look at cases of earthquakes of magnitude 6 or more. So these are pretty big earthquakes, occurring both over land and ones that are occurring in the ocean that did not result in a tsunami. So there are magnitude 6 earthquakes all the time, somewhere in the world. So we had a pretty big database of cases where we would see a large disruption on land, which presumably would disturb people, if people are in fact the source of this effect, and also earthquakes under the water, most of which people don't care about. And so the first distinction is, did it matter if it's on land or water? And the answer is yes. Okay. You see an effect when the earthquakes are on land. So that suggests what we're dealing with is people. The second thing is, was there a precursor before the earthquake? And the answer again is yes. And a matter of hours before the earthquake occurs, there appears to be a trend towards increasing disorder.
I find that fascinating, because this could then be a barometer for judging if there's going to be some kind of calamity or catastrophe. And is it normally some tragedy that registers, as opposed to, you know, hey, somebody just won $400 million in the lottery? I mean, do they spike that way too?
Yeah, it goes in both directions, both for celebrations and for negative events.
Okay. So
surprisingly, though, natural disasters generally don't have as big an effect as man-made disasters or as man-made celebrations.
Interesting. Now, by looking at the generators, can you determine if it's a tragedy or something of celebration?
At this point, no.
You can't. Okay.
No. The simple statistics that we're using, and also the limited number of generators that are running, we only have roughly 65 to 70 running at any given time, it doesn't give us enough of a signature, so to speak, to let us tell exactly the kind of event.
Do all the generators show the same thing when they start to spike?
Well, they don't show exactly the same thing, but what's very interesting is that the effect is occurring as a result of correlations that are appearing among separated generators. In other words, you have 75 generators ultimately in different cities around the world.
Okay.
What you see happening is that generators that are widely separated sometimes by thousands of miles, they begin to look similar. They begin to behave similarly. They don't look exactly the same, but they look similar, and they shouldn't look similar at all, because, again, the generators are designed for every single bit to be independent of every other bit, and yet they're not. So this suggests that there's something like a field effect, that is, the size of the entire planet that appears during these periods of very high mental attention.
How long do the spikes last?
That seems to depend on the nature of the event. So if you have an event that's like the stroke of midnight on New Year's, that event lasts roughly 5 minutes. There's a build-up of a couple minutes before, and then there's New Year's, and then everyone relaxes. So it's a very fast, what I would call an impulse event. So the effect is quite short. Other things, like a funeral of a celebrity, might last 3 or 4 hours if it's broadcast around the world, and so that's a much longer event. Or the opening of the Olympics, for example, is a very long event, and the effects that we see then are dependent on how long the apparent number of people are paying attention to that event.
Dean, this is ongoing. Are they still happening? You still got the generators out all over the place?
Yep, it's ongoing.
Okay. We'll have to see what happens.
Yeah, well, we're coming up on 15 years now. So one of the reasons why we want to keep it going is because we want to go through at least one solar cycle. It takes around 11 years to go from solar min to solar max. And so we now have data that goes through an entire cycle, and we'll be interested to keep tracking it, because now we can start looking at how geocosmic events may also influence these kinds of measures.
Okay, Dean, let's also get into some of the other things that you've been researching. Tell me a little bit about this experiment with tea that has been blessed. What is that?
So this is an interesting experiment. You're probably aware that in China, the tea ceremony is an important ritual, but it also involves intention. Intention is a very important component of the tea ceremony. And since I've been studying intention for many years now, I wondered whether the act of intention in the tea ceremony actually made any difference. And from a larger perspective, you can say, well, there are lots of rituals that happen where people use very focused intention, and we call it blessing of food. Well, does that make any difference? So what we did was, with a colleague in Taiwan, we asked three senior Buddhist monks from a Buddhist temple in Taiwan to bless a batch of oolong tea. And then we tested to see whether the people getting the blessed tea versus identical tea that wasn't blessed, whether their mood would change as a result of getting the blessed tea.
I love this experiment.
And this, of course, is under double-blind conditions. So
okay.
People receiving the tea don't know which tea they got. They
right.
know that one they might get it blessed and they might not.
It all looks the same, right?
Right. So what happens is we created a big batch of oolong tea, separated it into two, half of it was blessed, and then we recruited 200 people and distributed it among the 200 people. And by the way, the people in each of those two groups now, the ones getting the blessed tea and the ones getting not blessed tea, they were matched according to age, gender, amount of tea that they would drink, and a psychological trait called neuroticism. And we measured that because the more neurotic you are, the more your mood will fluctuate naturally. So we balanced on every aspect that we can think of to get the two groups to be about the same.
Okay.
Now they were distributed the tea, and they were told that this would be done every day for 1 week. These 200 people would participate every day for 1 week.
Sipping the tea.
Well, they'd only drink the teas on day 3, 4, and 5. And the reason for that is, at the end of the first day, they fill out a standardized mood reporting scale.
Without any tea, without any influence.
That's right.
Okay.
And everyone fill it out at the same time, all 200 people in Taiwan. And so because our measure is mood, we have to be very careful that mood is not being influenced by weather changes. So everyone would be influenced the same.
Good point.
Taiwan. Also that they wouldn't be influenced by world events. And other things like that.
Or personal issues, right?
Right. Well, personal issues for each individual we can't control, but we can control some things like weather and world events. So at the end of the day, each person fills out their mood. On day one, they do the same thing on day two. On day three, they're told at 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. to drink little bottles of tea that we gave them.
Now, do they all know that some tea's been blessed and some hasn't? Regardless of whether they get it or not, do they know about that?
Yes,
they do
know that they might be getting the blessed tea or they might not, but they have no idea.
Was there any kind of placebo effect here?
Well, that's an important component of the test. So, and I'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
So,
well, hold on for a second, Dean. We're going to hit this break, and we'll get right back into the tea experiment on Coast to Coast AM. And we're with Dean Radin as we talk about his latest work, Supernormal Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities. Hey, by the way, take a look at our internet-based television show, Beyond Belief. It's a TV show because a lot of people just plug it right into their flat screen through their tablets or their smartphones, and they watch the whole show on their big flat screen. Simple as that. Beyond the Belief, this Friday, the guest will be Dr. Louis Turi. So make sure you watch some of his predictions. 10 days free. How do you see it? Where do you find it? Go to this website, GaiamTV.com/George. GaiamTV.com/George. And welcome back with Dean Redd. And Dean, back to the tea experiment. So they filled out forms on day one and two, and then later on, days three, four, five, they were asked to drink the tea a couple times a day.
Right. And then at the end of the day, they'd fill out their mood questionnaire again. And then on the last 2 days of the week, they would just fill out the mood questionnaire. So this gives us a baseline beforehand, the first 2 days, to measure what their mood is. 3 days in which to drink either the plain or the blessed tea, and then 2 days afterwards. I should mention also that this was actually a triple-blind test. What that means is that the people drinking the tea didn't know what kind of tea they got. The people giving them the tea, the ones who were distributing the tea, they didn't know either. And then when I got the data back, which the data was primarily the mood questionnaires, I didn't know who got which tea either. So there are three levels of blindedness to keep expectation controlled. So at the very end of the week, besides doing all of the mood questionnaires, they're asked one additional question, which was, do you believe that you got the blessed tea or the not blessed tea? And they could answer three ways. Yes, I believe they got it, or I believe they did not get it, or I don't know. So that was the key question besides mood, because that allowed us to explicitly test the placebo effect. So when you look at the final data on this, and you separate the people by according to what their belief was,
right,
their expectation, it pushes the mood extremely strong. There's absolutely no doubt that if you believe you're getting the blessed tea, your mood will be better than if you don't.
And if you believe you're getting the blessed tea, so not necessarily even getting the blessed tea, right?
Right. All you need is your belief, and that will push mood. So now we can ask a very interesting question. We can say, okay, we're going to look at all of the people who, in fact, believed that they were getting blessed tea, so we'll control that belief, and some of them actually got it, and some of them didn't get it. So that condition is called the placebo control,
okay,
for controlling their expectation. As it turns out, there was a statistically significant improvement in mood in people getting the blessed tea. So it was actually, in terms of percentage, a 200% increase in mood in people getting the blessed tea as compared to people not getting the blessed tea, even among those who all of them believed that they were actually getting it.
Now, if none of them were told, or none was told, I guess, singular, if none was told that they were getting blessed tea at all, or the possibility of, what do you think would happen if they didn't even know at all?
Well, then we wouldn't be able to easily test the placebo effect.
Okay.
Then they would have no expectation at all.
Okay. But you should, though, theoretically, you would have seen a spike with those who drank the blessed tea, even though they didn't know they were drinking.
In principle, we would have seen an increase, yes. But since we did know what the belief was, it also allowed us to look at what's called nocebo. And the nocebo are people who disbelieve that they're getting blessed tea. So these are all people who say, no, I don't think I'm getting the blessed tea.
Were they skeptics?
No, it's simply that their belief was, I don't think I'm getting it.
Okay.
So now you can compare the people in that group, some of whom actually did get the blessed tea, and some of them didn't. And so was there any difference in mood among those two groups? And the answer is no. There's no difference. So if you don't believe you're getting the blessed tea, it doesn't matter whether you're getting it or not. There shows no difference.
It's not going to happen. Hey, that's fascinating. So your belief system seems to me then got to be critical to making some of these things happen.
And the thing that shows that most clearly is what's called the placebo enhancement condition.
Now, what is that?
This is a condition where you only look at people who actually got the blessed tea, and you separate them according to ones who believe that they did and ones who believe that they did not. This is a condition you just mentioned. Because now what we're doing is saying, does belief modulate whether or not the blessing works? Because after all, these are all people who actually got the blessed tea. But we're looking to see how belief makes a difference. It makes a gigantic difference. The difference in these two groups was 700% improvement in people getting the blessed tea who believed that they were, as compared to people getting the blessed tea who believe that they did not. 700%. So this is no longer just an interesting statistical effect. It's a massive change in mood, which is a behavioral effect, simply as a result of getting blessed tea and believing that it is in fact blessed.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's a huge effect. So we see this in other laboratory studies where we ask people, you know, whenever somebody does an experiment, they know generally what the experiment is about. One of the questions you can ask then is, do you believe that you'll be able to do this, whatever the experiment is? If they say yes, then they're likely to be able to do it. If they say no, I don't believe I can do that, they're very likely they won't be able to do it. So again, we see how simply being open to the possibility of being able to do something, in this case, psychic, makes a huge difference. It's a very strong modulator.
You know, you could use it in your everyday life, Dean, in order to do things. If you think positively and very powerfully, you probably can accomplish a lot of things.
Well, this, in a sense, is a formalized way of testing the power of positive thinking.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And at least in this case, under triple bind conditions, people react to blessed tea in a very, very different way than people who don't believe it.
Let's go through some of the other experiments, and we'll get into your book, Supernormal, next hour here.
Okay.
You had an experiment that studied the interactions between mind and light. What was that?
Well, this is a new series now. We've been working on this for about 5 years. We've done 14 experiments on this so far. The idea is almost all of our previous studies have looked at mind and matter interactions. So in a way, the intentional tea experiment is a mind-matter interaction. What we're interested in now is looking at the interaction between mind and light, specifically photons, little particles of light. So this is now looking at mind-energy interactions rather than mind-matter, per se. Even though we know that matter and energy are related to each other, this is now looking directly at something that is considered energetic. And more importantly, We're using photons because we wanted a way to do an experiment of this type that wasn't simply interested in it for its psychic ability, but that would be relevant to a mainstream problem in physics. And so what we're doing is using a very classic Physics 101 double-slit optical interferometer. This is the easiest way of demonstrating the mysteries of quantum mechanics. You use an interferometer, you send photons through two tiny little slits, and when a camera looks at the pattern that's created, it creates an interference pattern. Somehow the light is interfering with itself. Well, this is a way that in elementary physics classes, you can demonstrate the wave and particle nature of light. Well, all that we've done in this experiment is, rather than what you would do in a physics experiment, what you're interested in is to put a detector next to the double slit. And if the detector will tell you which of the two slits the photon goes through, if you know that information, then the interference pattern goes away and the photons start behaving like particles. And if you turn the detector off and you can't tell which of the two slits the photon goes through, then you have an interference pattern, which is a wave-like behavior. So this is simply turning the detector on and off will cause a photon to behave like a wave or a particle. This is an essential mystery in quantum mechanics.
Okay.
And it's called the quantum measurement problem. Like the measurement, you take a measurement of this quantum system and suddenly the photons seem to know what you're doing. All right, so there's an unresolved problem. We said, okay, let's do an experiment where instead of putting a physical detector in front of the double slit, why don't we just ask people to use their mind's eye, and imagine that they could see what was going on in the vicinity of the double slit.
A little like remote viewing.
It's exactly remote viewing.
Okay.
It's an experiment in using clairvoyance as a form of detector, or remote viewing as a form of detector.
Mm-hmm.
Simply see what's happening to the light. And if it turns out that remote viewing has the capacity to actually get information from a distance, which of course what remote viewing is all about, then we could predict that in a double-slit interferometer system, you should be able to collapse the wave-like nature of light into particles. And you'd see that immediately as a change in the interference pattern. So we have a sealed optical system. It's 2 meters away from the person. The person has to mentally imagine that they could see what's going on inside the box and around the vicinity of the double slit and measure the interference pattern. And then we'd ask the person to withdraw their mind. We do this back and forth in a counterbalanced way. 30 seconds mind in the box, 30 seconds mind out of the box, and back and forth, you know, over a period of about a half an hour. So we've done hundreds and hundreds of sessions, of half-hour sessions with lots and lots of people. And overall, there's no question statistically that the optical system is behaving as though the mind's eye is the same as a kind of detector, physical detector. So this, in a way, is the world's most expensive and complicated remote viewing experiment, because it is showing that the mind's eye really can get information from a distance. And it's relevant to quantum mechanics because it says there's something about mind and consciousness that seems to be involved in the way that the quantum potential world turns into the actual world as we experience it.
Another great experiment. Now, the one that really fascinates me is you did a brain activity study of mediums as they were trying to communicate with the dead. What results there?
Right. So there's a question here. This was done with our colleagues at the Winbridge Institute. They specialize in mediumship research. And so what we did was, one of the questions about mediumship is, maybe their subjective experience is that they're communicating with the dead, but maybe they're hallucinating. Maybe they're making it up.
Yeah.
We can't measure directly what's happening in a subjective state. So one of the tasks that we did in this experiment, and we used highly trained research mediums from the Winbridge Institute. These are people who have already gone through a series of tests to confirm that they have some ability. We brought them into our lab. We measured 32 channels of EEG in the brain. And we had them do four tasks. One was simply think about an imaginary person. The second was to actually communicate with a discarnate, to do whatever they do when they're doing mediumship. The third was to listen to a story that was told to them. And the fourth was to think about a living person that the medium knew. So there's four different subjective mental states. Under a skeptical hypothesis, you would say that, well, these are all imagination, and so there shouldn't be any changes in the brain. It should all be about the same. But as it turns out, among the six mediums, one showed very clearly, and another showed the same trend, that when they were doing mediumship, talking to a discarnate, their brain was a very different state. So we know that whatever they were doing, it wasn't simply imagining, and it wasn't listening to a story, it wasn't thinking about a living person, it was something else. Now, exactly what else it is the second part of the experiment, in which we measured to see whether the medium was getting accurate information about that discarnate. And so the same medium that showed a very different brain state actually got significantly good accuracy on two different clients that they were reading. So it's moving towards a way of understanding how do we measure this subjective state and verify not only that the medium's getting real useful information, but that they're not making it up. The brain actually is in a very different state.
So that
study's not published yet, so I can't go into much more detail, but that's
pretty dramatic, though. And then let's get into distant healing on surgical wounds. How did you accomplish that?
This was a study where we recruited women who were getting reconstructive surgery after breast cancer.
Okay, pretty dramatic.
And women who were getting elective surgery for cosmetic reasons. Two different classes. In all cases, their photograph was given to one or more distant healers, who over the course of 8 days would focus healing intention on the woman to help heal their wounds, their surgical wounds. And there were two measures of interest. One was an objective measure of wound healing, which measures something called collagen deposition. This is the substance that binds together a wound, and you can measure it pretty precisely when wounds are healing, And it's an objective way of saying how much did the wound heal. The second measure were things like mood and how did you feel as a result of over this 8 days of recuperation. The bottom line of this was that the distant healing did not actually improve the wound healing. And in fact, it was the opposite. That one of the measures asked of the healers were, do you feel like you're really connected with the patient? And the correlation then between how much they thought they were interacting with the patient was negatively correlated with how the patient felt to quite a significant degree. So in this case, we weren't showing a distant healing effect. We were showing the opposite. We're showing there was a real effect, only it was actually making them worse instead of better. So we thought about this for a while, and we decided that possibly what was going on is that when distant healing happens, and we've seen this in other experiments.
That's dramatic, though. Jeez.
Yeah, I mean, it causes you to pause, among other things. What we've seen in many experiments where we simply ask somebody to think about somebody else intently, we measure their physiology. What we see about in the person's physiological condition who's being thought about intently, like the feeling of being stared at, we see a sympathetic arousal. This is the kind of physiological response, like a fight or flight response. You get all pumped up. It turns out that for healing of wounds, that kind of stress is exactly the wrong thing to do. You want people to be exceptionally calm and not pumped up. And so what this might suggest to us is that when distant healers are doing whatever they do, they might be acting as though they're as an intense staring effect. You know, they're putting huge amounts of focused intention on another person, and the person who's receiving that intention, actually, it may not be so good. It may arouse them, and what you want to do is calm them. So this study then may also help explain why some of the other distant healing studies haven't worked so well, because it may turn out that you need to give a kind of prescription to the healers to either energize the person. Like if the patient is depressed, you want to energize them. If the patient's recovering from surgical wounds, you don't. You want to calm them down.
Does the patient need to believe that it can be accomplished, that he can be healed that way?
We also did measure expectation in this case. And the expectation did not make a big effect on these women. So in this case, there wasn't a big placebo response.
That's very dramatic. Dean, the work on Supernormal, I want to spend some time next hour with, because this is equally fascinating as you tie in science and yoga for the evidence for extraordinary psychic abilities. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. Also, we've added Instagram now to the website, so you can follow along. That's going to grow. Just simply go up to coasttocoastam.com. That's up there near the Facebook and Twitter icons in the far right-hand corner.